Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello everyone, and you're very welcome to the Tillage Podcast. I'm Siobhan Walsh, Tillage Editor Andy Doyle is here, and we're recording on Thursday morning, the 8th of December this week. The frost is down outside. I think we're down to -3 degrees in some places this week. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk how that frost is affecting fieldwork and pests in the field. We'll hear about fertiliser sales, glyphosate renewal. We'll look at milling wheat on the tillage pages, and of course, as always, we'll have grain markets and weather. Andy, before the hard frost this week, there was a good bit of spraying going on. There was beet being pulled. There's bits of ploughing going on across the country as well. So what are you seeing out there, Andy, or what are you hearing from people on the phone?
Siobhan, pretty much the same as what you've just said. A number of people able to be out with sprayers. I suppose for the last 2 weeks, people were wondering, would the frost get them out or to get herbicides, etc. out? But I think a lot of people maybe were taken a bit by surprise that ground had actually soaked out very well. And even ahead of the frost, they were able to travel very well with absolutely minimal damage to tram lines, which I guess they weren't expecting. Now, an odd field here and there, still not trafficable. That's just because of the nature of the field and springs and that type of stuff. So that'll always happen. But in the main, people have been able to get out and get work done. Now, again, in conversation, and we've met up with a lot of people over the last week, almost nobody, in a sense, willing to go now to consider further planting. There was planting done 3 weeks ago, and there's still no sign of the seeds up because those soil temperatures have dropped and everything is going to go much more slowly. And if you thought you wouldn't have a problem with crows, that might not be so bad. But the vast majority of people all over the country are reporting big amounts of crows, even relative to what they would normally expect. And I'm thinking it's probably a consequence ultimately of the number of mild winters that we've had. You know, it's much easier on nature. And a hard winter, in a sense, has a much greater culling effect. So that's what's going on at the moment, and that's where the pressures are coming from.
Yeah, like we had a very dry summer, Andy, and we're getting a hard frost now. Like the dryness in the summer, I know at times it wasn't good for all crops, but it was good for soil, and the frost is good for the soil as well.
Yeah, Siobhan, and I would say that one of the reasons why people would be surprised at how quickly ground soaked was the relative absence of damage on most land all through harvest. You know, damage to land when it happens is permanent. It's not just temporary in that you can loosen it up again with a subsoiler or with a cultivator or a plough. Damage is generally permanent. So whenever you cause damage, it stays there for a lot longer than you'd like it to stay. So avoiding damage, either by being careful in what you can do, and that's seldom possible, or with the help of the dry conditions that give soil much greater carrying capacity. There's great benefit in that for the following crop as well. And I suppose the one thing that I'm a small bit surprised with when I say that then is how come there were so many patches in fields that have died. Yeah. You know, we do see water in fields, and I'm thinking that we're probably looking at an amount of fine soil drifting over the surface and clogging up the various saucers and the ponds and the corners of headlands. Yeah. Where ins and outs have left holes over time, and water sits in them then because it can't get away. But it's certainly the benefit of a good summer extends beyond that year.
Yeah, definitely, Andy. Yeah. Andy, like, I suppose other things then that people are thinking about at the minute, like the big one on people's minds is probably aphids and how this cold weather is going to affect them.
Yeah, and that's a question that remains difficult to answer. I mean, the one thing that we can be reasonably sure of is that in the cold conditions that are there, we're not going to get aphid multiplication. So yeah, that's kind of relatively straightforward. That could mean that a single infected plant in a corner of a field stays as a single infected plant. But cold per se is unlikely to kill the aphids. What happens is that as the cold intensifies, all cold-blooded animals migrate deeper into the soil to be protected by the soil. And therefore, in the main, they'll be there to come back again when things thaw out and warm up. So if they're infected with virus before they go into the soil and they climb up onto a new plant, they will be climbing up to infect a new and a neighbouring plant, granted. But this is where circles of infection come from. And depending on how often that can happen or how much multiplication can take place on individual plants. We've all seen this where the aphids are kind of almost thick on the leaves. When they fall off because of density and size, they climb up onto the plant next door. And this is how a single plant from a single aphid moves an infection from a plant to a circle to a patch. And it's all to do with multiplication. So when the weather picks up again, we're going to have probably more activity of aphids. And the big question, and I don't know the answer to this, but the question that I would pose is there any point in putting an aphicide in the tank if you're going out today, tomorrow or the next day in frosty conditions? It's probably okay for the herbicides, but if the aphids are not above ground, and they might not be above ground for 2 or 3 weeks, can that aphicide do any work of consequence for you? I just don't know the answer to that. If they came back up quite quickly, I'd say the answer is yes. But all products have a lifespan that exist and reside on the surface of leaves, and that's where the aphicides would be, because they're not translocated into the plant, and they're not absorbed through the skin of the aphid to any great extent either. They can be, but not to any great extent.
Yeah, if I was an aphid, I don't think I'd be out in that weather anyway.
Well, if you were self-respecting, you wouldn't be anyway.
some of that, we often talk about that infection last year. Like, we kind of assume a lot of it happened in January and February. So, you know, while we mightn't go with the aphicide now, there might still be a time to go with that into the new year or near the end of the month or whatever.
Yeah, and Siobhan, it's ironic, as I look back at previous years this week, I discover that this particular week has been cold for the last two seasons.
Okay.
You know, a quick and a sudden snap where we were down this week last year. Last week last year, we were down to between 2 and 5 degrees C of soil temperatures. Now we're between 5 and 7. So now they're probably after dropping again today and yesterday, but they were the numbers that I was using earlier in the week. And it's ironic that there's that the same week is kind of been repeated now over 3 years. But we can't, my quick answer is we can't take confidence from the cold snap this week to be able to do much or anything for us in terms of removing the risk of BYDV. So if the field is at high risk, then it's the risk is still there. If it's at low risk, well, then there may be no risk. That's the great irony of it. You know, if it's not long up and you had no reason to have infection of consequence, and the stubble was clean before it was ploughed, and you didn't actually plough down or incorporate aphids on foliage, because that's a common enough way that the whole system transmits as well. You have a lot of foliage on a crop. You could say you spray it off with a glyphosate and it looks yellow and it won't recover. But if that stubble ground was carrying aphids, those aphids are still there. And when they're down in the ground, they will eventually get an opportunity, or a proportion of them will eventually get an opportunity to crawl back up. And they're already infected from the stubble. You don't need winged aphids to bring it about.
Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah,
it's complicated. We all in the early days of BYDV research, so I'm going back into the late 70s and 80s, the common advice, if you were coming out of grass, because there was always an assumption that grass carried virus. I'm not so sure we have ever absolutely confirmed that. We know some grasses do, but I don't know if an actual grass field carries virus or not. But anyway, the assumption was that the grass did carry virus and carry aphids, and that it was good practice ahead of planting after lay to use paraquat at the time rather than Roundup, because paraquat was killing almost everything, and that's why we don't have it anymore. And I have to say, I would have seen examples of that also in fields over time.
Look, there is research coming on this, and Louise McNamara in Oak Park has published some findings. I think it's at the start of this month, but she'll be talking at the National Tillage Conference as well on the 25th of January, and no doubt there'll be big interest in hearing that talk on the latest update on that research.
There's a huge amount of research needed, and it's absolutely fantastic to see so much of the very valuable research taking place in Chagask, because it's using Irish conditions, Irish data, Irish monitoring, etc. And it may contribute to the international effort, but it's really, really valuable and complements to Chagask for investing in that type of research. And like, there's always going to be questions. We also know, you and I and many farmers, that we now have varieties in the marketplace, specifically Jaiu winter barley, that is tolerant to virus.
Yeah.
But tolerant is not the same as resistant. So we believe that it's probably, we can see infection, but the infection doesn't cause a lot of yield implications or growth implications for the plant. But the question is still there. Just because the virus doesn't affect the crop, can aphids multiply on it and transmit from that crop, if it was unsprayed, to a spring barley crop 4, 5, 6 months down the road? And these are real questions that the research will hopefully be able to give some information on as we go. Because again, to give listeners perspective, the research that they're doing enables them to look at every aphid that's flying, and then to identify the specific aphids that are associated with the transmission of the serial viruses, and then that they can actually go in to each individual aphid and see what specific virus that aphid is carrying. Because if those aphids that are flying are carrying no virus, we don't really have a big threat, except you have ploughed down real dirty stubbles.
Yeah. Okay. Andy, you mentioned glyphosate there, and glyphosate has been renewed for another season. So the commission, I think it was the 2nd of December, the commission basically renewed it, and it's renewed until the 15th of December 2023.
Yeah, and Siobhan, I might just add to that it's probably not renewed. It's the existing license has been extended because the renewal system was not able to adjudicate on all of the information that was submitted during the re-registration process.
Yeah, fair enough.
Everything has to go through a process, and the process couldn't be met on time. So it's getting its 1 year extended lifespan. What happens after that, I don't know, because there was still a lot of resistance even to giving it that one-year extension, which it was completely entitled to within law, and yet people thought that they should vote against it. So,
if it had went this month, Andy, it was use and sale, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was automatic. Yeah.
If you had Roundup in stock, like, and you know, it's dodgy territory to be in, and the price of it at the minute and everything as well. Andy, I was at ITLIS last week, the Tillage and Land Use Society, the winter conference, and look, we'll have the report in the paper next week on that, but just wanted to mention ITLIS had a Grain for Ukraine appeal, and they made the presentation for the Irish Red Cross, and they made the presentation to Charlie Lamson. He's head of fundraising at the Irish Red Cross at the conference, and they had a target of €5,000, and they raised over 10,000, I think it was 10,500 euro, for that Grain for Ukraine appeal. So just well done to ITLIS members on that. It's a big amount of money to raise.
And Siobhan, I might just say, for those who don't know, that ITLIS is the Irish Tillage and Land Use Society, which is a grouping, a choice to be there or not, but a grouping of people with vested interests in the tillage sector. And, you know, they organise things and have done for years. And I've been involved heavily with it for years, just organising conferences, workshops, tours, visits, all just for people who want to be educated in different elements of the tillage industry.
Yeah, it's a great organisation to be in, and it's farmers and it's people who work in the industry, and a very enjoyable conference last week. Lots of different topics in it. You know, that you'd keep it interested for the whole day. But look, we can talk about the winter conference next week anyway. Fertiliser sales, Andy, have declined, and look, there's no real shock there. The fertiliser price is really what's driving this decline. But I suppose the three big things, we have this in the paper this week in the news section, and like, we have a target there to reduce nitrogen use. So from a baseline of 408,000 in 2018, we have to reduce nitrogen use. So this is artificial nitrogen tons, so nutrient nitrogen. So the actual tons of nitrogen that are in the fertilizer have to go from 408,000 tons in 2018 to 350,000 tons in 2025 and 325,000 tons by 2030. And at the minute, we're meeting that target. So nitrogen, artificial nitrogen sales fell by 14% this year, down to 343,000, just over 343,000 tons. So we're exceeding the target that's there at the minute. Now, that's not to say by 2025 where we'll be. But I suppose it's a positive. In all this climate debate, Andy, you know, we hear about the agriculture needs to do more, but here we are exceeding the target. The target, of course, is set out in Ag Climatise. That's the Department of Agriculture's roadmap to get to climate neutrality by 2050. So we are exceeding in that. And I suppose looking at the year ahead, Andy, CAN is at 850, 860. You know, tillage farmers will seriously be looking at reducing nitrogen again next year.
Yeah, Siobhan, look, it's ironic when those figures came out, as you rightly said, there was no surprise to anybody in it. Indeed, they were being indicated long before the official figures came to the market.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's still an issue behind them, in that in the springtime of this year, you and I will have spoke on a podcast about the opportunity, not the opportunity, the need for people to look at that last 5, 10, 50 and 20% of nitrogen. How much of a kick did they feel they were getting from it? Because the very last 10%, it probably really doesn't bring an awful lot of extra yield a lot of the time. It just tries to ensure that in a year where the response is slightly lower, that you have more than enough to keep driving it on. People had kind of stood back and looked at that, and there was certainly a willingness in the tillage sector to cut back on nitrogen because of the cost price benefit. But then prices went for a walk, grain prices went for a walk, and all of the extra fertilizer could be accounted for, could pay for itself ultimately. But on the other livestock side of the house, basically what we have is the same intensive use on some elements of grassland generally associated with dairy, while a lot of the beef industry cut back or didn't use any in the year gone by. And, you know, that's still leaving the significant concentration of nitrogen in areas where there's likely to be losses from. And, you know, the tonnage alone, it's a target that has to be met, but it won't solve other problems unless other things are done.
Yeah, so yeah, not all the people who need to be cutting the nitrogen or the big users of it still aren't cutting back.
And Siobhan, you report week after week elsewhere in the paper about the great benefit that clovers are bringing to the nitrogen requirement and yield growth and multi-species swards as well. And they will all contribute to the reduced intensification in individual fields. And ultimately, that does decrease the intensification across regions. Even if it's only 10% of all fields have either clover or multi-species and they're getting less nitrogen, that decreases the intensity. And in the tilling sector, you know, every crop of pulses that we put in is zero N. And less N in the following year as well, if people are doing their husbandry properly. And all those things will make a difference in time. And, you know, we are looking at an effort to try and increase the area under beans with more higher prices and a higher target yield for next year. When I say higher prices, higher aid for next year. So, you know, people would be foolish not to be looking at these if for no other reason than to decrease their exposure to fertilizer bills.
Oh, definitely. People should definitely be looking at beans for the fertilizer saving alone. And indeed, you know, maybe those dairy farmers should be looking at beans as well, not to grow them. But, you know, I've talked to a good few farmers who have high clover on their farm and they're afraid to go back on their nitrogen use. And I often say to them, well, we don't spread any nitrogen on our beans, and our beans are a legume like clover is. You know, so if you have high levels of clover in your swards, up over 70%, that clover, you know, from it might need a bit of nitrogen at the start of the year, but from April and May on, you know, the clover should be supplying that nitrogen, and we're able to grow the beans that way. So maybe they can take a leaf out of the tillage book. Worryingly, Andy, in those figures, phosphorus sales went down by 26% and potassium sales went down by 24%. And Chagas figures have recently shown that in 2021, the number of soils at optimum levels for pH, P and K went from 19% to 16%. So only 16% of our soils are at optimum levels for those for pH, P and K. And in the meantime, then we've had this massive drop in P and K sales. Like, that's very worrying. If we don't have our P and Ks at the right levels, we're going to be less efficient with our nitrogen, but we're also in a position where we're going to have to build those indexes up again. And, you know, it's very hard to build them up.
Yeah, it's easier to pull them down than it is to bring them up. But I think, Siobhan, one of the kind of background questions that somebody like me would have is, when you look at the nitrogen drop and then the P and K drop, you quickly ask yourself the question, is this really compound fertilizer that wasn't used across parts of the country where it would normally be used? And that would kind of very definitely seem like what it was. I know there was certainly a resistance, particularly for P, because the price of P was so, so high. But I hope that most people in the tillage sector would have heeded the advice to at least get the maintenance quantity of P on, even if you had to try and make savings by not putting on the building quantity. But if you don't put on any and you're drawn down, the it's a long road back up to get indices back up again. So no, none shouldn't be an option for anybody. But then look at, if you're going to go back on your stocking rate as a response to a fodder crisis and you're cutting back on nitrogen, you can probably equally argue there's not a lot of point in putting on P and K because you're not driving the production anyway.
Fair point.
You know, at the end of the day, at the end of the day, the comment is mainly targeted at grassland farmers, you know, if you have any money to spend as an extensive grassland farmer, spend it online.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let nature do more of the work for you, and that's still good farming practice.
Yeah.
After that, worry about getting the P and the K up, but the lime is the starting point for everybody.
Yeah, it's the first thing we should be doing. Just while I have the figures in front of me, Andy, you said that compound fertilizer used in lime. It went from 992,000 tons to 748,000 tons, while straights increased. Now, we don't know what those straights were, but I suppose you would assume most of those straights were nitrogen fertilizer. So I just said I'd say them while I have the figures there in front of me.
And Siobhan, I also think there's quite a lot more straight potash gone out. But again, just as keeping the ear to the ground, talking to people in both grass and tillage, I hear of people putting on straight K to supplement the compound or to deal with heavy offtakes of silage in grassland. It's absolutely good husbandry to put straights where one, at the end of the day, there's no point in learning on phosphate, even though everybody says they want it if you're short K. There's no point in learning on phosphate if you're not going to put on nitrogen. So everything that you do in the soil and about soil fertility is about getting the balance right. And that can only be guided by soil test results.
Yeah, and it is great to see farmers doing that, because when you look at some of those compounds, and especially some of the grassland ones, you know, 27, 2.5, 10, or, you know, 27, 2.5, 5. I mean, the K is so low in them, and a lot of farmers are probably spreading them on their silage ground where they should be putting on 100 units of K.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need to see more people putting on straight potash. Yeah. Andy, we'll move on. And on the tillage pages this week, you're talking about mill and wheat, and you were at the Protein I group last week. You might just explain a bit about the group, I suppose, first.
Okay, Siobhan. Look, I was asked if I would facilitate a discussion that Protein I group was having on milling wheat, and I was delighted to be able to take up the opportunity, because it's a conversation that needs to be had. The Protein I group is a group that's headed by University College Dublin, but it also involves University in Galway, Queen's, I think the University of Ulster, UCC. So it's a big amalgam of research organisations, and a number of the people that are directly involved are coming out of the health faculties in the different universities and research centres. That's a huge addition to the debate on milling and diet and what people need and how we get people to consume the things that they need to keep them healthy in the long term. So basically, it was about producing proteins that were deemed to be important or essential for human diets, and finding ways to produce that or manufacture it sustainably over time. It wasn't just generating something new and out of the blue. It was about trying to do it sustainably. And if we take the Irish food industry today, all diets require basic carbohydrates. And the only carbohydrate of quantity that the Irish farming system supplies to the food sector, food sector, is potato. You know, we send nothing in the line of bread, which is the other and very important basic. You know, traditionally we have potatoes probably once a day, and then you could have breads or that type of material two or three or even four times a day, be it the sandwiches, be it the snack, would be the cheese on it, whatever. You know, all of those things are there. And we can't supply any of them. And I think the level of exposure was intensified during the early COVID months of lockdown, when people took to making their own or baking, even if it was only for entertainment purposes. But the shelves basically ran bare of flour.
Yeah.
At least there's a chance there could be some Irish wheat in some of the retail flour. There's not a lot some years. It tends to fluctuate. There may be some. It's not a lot in terms of overall consumption. So, you know, the the question as to whether or not we could stand back and politically accept zero self-sufficiency in a standard carbohydrate staple food is something that I certainly feel needs to be debated. I'm not saying that we should change it, but we should debate it. And that's what that workshop was about. It was asking, you know, what does the baking industry need? And there was lots of people there from the baking side, nobody from the bread side that I'm conscious of, but a lot of people there who are using flour and for different purposes, maybe not bread,
biscuits or whatever.
Biscuits and pretzels and that type of stuff, you know. People are doing all kinds of things, and then quickly you identify that there's quite a bit of artisan production going on. People that are getting maybe 50 100 maybe 200 kilos of wheat, milling it probably themselves and making their local product, whatever it is, and selling it as Irish. And it is Irish, grown, produced from Irish wheat, milled locally, baked locally. But we don't have a handle on just how big that is or how much wheat is used for that purpose. I mean, it became very obvious in the conversation early on that we are limited in terms of the suitability of Irish grown wheats to produce flours for certain markets. That we have to accept. Now, we do also have to ask, well, are modern varieties better? And are there varieties out there that would be better than the ones we had 30, 40 years ago when we did have a milling industry in Ireland? And the bottom line is we don't know the answer to that unless we look and see. And, you know, somebody will look and see once we begin to ask the right questions. But certainly across the floor at every end of the industry, there was kind of a unanimous agreement that a zero policy isn't right. But there was also questions as to, you know, could we realistically re-engage with the bread making sector? And, you know, that becomes a much more difficult question in terms of trying to give the answer to it. But the question that I would pose, and I have posed it for surely 20 years at this point, is we grow wheat, we always grew wheat. What can we make from the wheat we grow? And given that we are always subject to inclement weather prior to harvest and the risk of sprouting is there, and that's a real problem for the milling industry, are there things we could make almost irrespective of that? And look, somebody like me would also pose the question that if we got a variety that was really good for the production of flour for whatever niche markets that there are, if we could get that variety, could we use modern technologies to reduce, minimize, or even eliminate the risk of sprouting in that variety prior to harvest? You know, they're all real questions that are there that have to go into the melting pot in the future. But certainly sprouting has been a really big problem in the past for people. There's lots of other things as well, Siobhan. There's you know, if you produce milling wheat, you have to be much more careful when you're drying it. You have to use lower temperatures initially to remove the higher amounts of water. You can up it a little bit later if you're putting it back in at low moistures, because you damage the protein. Heat always damages protein. It's just a fact of life. So again, all of these things that are there, they all have to be thought of. And I don't know, people probably don't think about it, but if you walked into a supermarket, how many different things would you find on shelves that are made from wheat, or with wheat, where wheat is an important ingredient? Like, I don't know, is it, well, it's a lot more than tens, it's certainly hundreds, and it's probably thousands. You know, go as simple as pasta, couscous, bread, white bread, brown bread, a myriad of different biscuits. Imagine if you used the flour that you make for a sliced pan to try and make a Marietta biscuit. That's a little flat thing squeezed up and dense. You know, if you put in the bread flour in there, all that flour wants to do is blow up and expand. So all of these things have to have different specs in them. And it's interesting that the day didn't just confine itself to wheat, because there's an amount of work going on looking at the advantages of ingredients of other cereals and other crops, other grains, to go back and to use them in flours that make a whole range of different products, purely for health reasons. Beta-glucans are an entity that are useful in terms of preventing artery disease, if I remember correctly, as in cholesterol type diseases. Yeah. Beta-glucans are relatively low in wheat, higher in oats, but much higher again in barley. So they've been looking at taking barley flour and putting it into wheat flour to transfer the beta-glucans into the diet. So this is where a lot of things will go. And I would also ask the question that if we hear, and we do hear probably once every 3 months, articles continuing to reappear on the media with regard to obesity, you know, the drive to brown breads rather than white breads, going back to the traditional loaf that we had many, many decades ago, you know, is that a better way for to structure a new milling industry if there was to be one developed? So these are all the questions that were there on the day, and we hope to be able to take some ideas, some of those ideas, into platforms where they can be examined.
Yeah. And Andy, was there anyone from the department there, from government, or, you know, were they sitting in listening to this conversation?
Yes, the Department of Agriculture variety people were there listening. You know, the Department of Agriculture have always identified if there's a market, then we research the varieties.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, do they go researching varieties, wondering if people will redevelop a milling industry? I would say no is the answer to that. So everything has to restart somewhere. Which is the chicken, which is the egg? Can we find a market first? Would people buy Irish flour if it was made? Irish flours, plural, because it could be peas as well. Peas are being looked at as an element of the ingredients. So if people wanted, if there are people who would put a value on getting the Irish product rather than the imported product, then we can take the conversation further. And if you identify there's a market, well, what size of a market for what spec? And you begin to do these sums and begin to organise the market. And, you know, I know I threw into the conversation the fact that what we see in the chip industry at the moment is a straight tie-up between an individual grower and an individual chipper. And one depends on the other if they're going to use Irish chips. So all of a sudden, you don't need contracts. You don't need any of this stuff. You don't need locked in premium, because the thing doesn't work unless both parties are happy. And that's how it's a potential model, particularly if we're going to develop an industry which is predominantly based on niche products, local areas, health driven, or local driven, or whatever. So these are the questions that have to evolve as we go.
Absolutely. Andy, you mentioned markets there, and I think just the clock is ticking on, so we'll move on to grain markets and where they sit. And they were up and down this week anyway, but I think mainly they've taken a drop.
Unquestionably, it's still down, Siobhan. You know, we would have talked about dry price markets in the order of 340s, 350s a ton for December 22 a few months ago. Last Friday, the futures market closed at 326.50, if I remember correctly. We're talking on Thursday morning now, and it closed on Wednesday night at 307.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you could say, almost dropping a fiver almost every day. And I think as importantly for people looking at the year ahead, you know, we talked about the cost of nitrogen and the cost of the input versus the value of the output. December 23 wheat today is in there at 281. You know, that would have been 325 a while ago. But 281 is taking you back to 240 for green wheat. 240 for green wheat is 230 for green barley. That's the price of 2021. 220 for green barley, and people would really have to be asking serious questions about what to grow and where to grow it at those prices if fertilizer was costing you 50, 60, 70 euro an acre more. Yeah. So there's real hard questions to be asked, but it also complements the comment we made a minute ago, Siobhan, that at those price levels, it's hard to not consider beans as a sensible part absolutely. Of the rotation in the year ahead.
Yeah, absolutely, Andy. Yeah. And I suppose, like, what's driving that at the minute? I know at the ITLIS conference last week, you know, it was mentioned there's expected to be a big maize crop coming out of Brazil in the springtime. You know, what's the main drivers behind that drop at the minute, Andy?
Probably one of the main drivers, Siobhan, is that there is nothing that says that grain is going to be scarce.
Yeah.
And they have prices have been high for so long. The market gets tired. You know, we have been in a bull market for probably 9 months. And a bull market is where prices are going up or are likely to go up.
Yeah.
Bull markets, the phrase is that bull markets need feeding, quite like animals. And if they're not fed by information that says there's a need for them to go further, well, then they automatically want to go backwards. The main single element at the moment relates to the Black Sea Corridor. Part of the Black Sea Corridor agreement is that the international community find a way to free up to free up access of Russian exports onto international markets of grain and fertilizer specifically. So basically people believe that while it's not the case currently, that the having that Black Sea Corridor in place is going to not just continue the access to the Ukrainian grains to the market, but also ultimately free up access for Russian grains to the market. And Russia says that it has something over 40 million tons of wheat to export. And, you know, those exports have been slow from Russia. Now, there's a lot of factors there. It might not just be the banking arrangements that are slowing it down. A lot of countries may have difficulty using it as an import source. But look, if we're buying fertilizer, are we asking questions? And the answer probably is no, because everybody is hoping that if the fertilizer supply can be increased, that we hope that the price might drop. And that's the principle behind the way we all think, I guess, at the end of the day.
Andy, we'll move on then to weather. And we've mentioned there's the weekend anyway is to be fairly frosty, and there's warnings there in place for today and tomorrow. But the outlook, it's a bit unclear, is it?
Yeah, the outlook, the longer term outlook is unclear, Siobhan. But if I just give you that, I'll start with the temperature numbers. The maximum temperatures for the next week from this Thursday to Wednesday run day after day 2-2-1 minus 1-0-2-2. So they're very low daytime temperatures.
Yeah.
You know, I got into the car yesterday and I read zero, but I have to confess it didn't feel like zero outside because there was no breeze. And generally speaking, I think low wind speeds will also be a feature of the week ahead. But they were the maximum temperatures, Siobhan. When it comes to minimum temperatures, and this is average, there will be people that will get a lot lower than this. -3, -1, -2, -2, -3, -4, -4. So, you know, there's going to be water pipes that are going to be frozen for the next week if they're not insulated. So that's kind of what those temperatures mean. The longer term forecast has the cold spell going on a bit beyond the end of that, but not necessarily continuing at or below zero for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. That's not in the forecast at the moment. That's not to say that it couldn't happen, but it's not in the forecast for the moment. Rainfall for the week ahead, then we haven't seen so many zeros for a long time, and comfort the people in the Midlands northeast and southwest, there's zeros there every day for those regions. Looking into the forecast beyond the week ahead, there are certainly showers in the forecast, or the probability of showers in the forecast. And they're not saying whether they're going to be heavy or light, but it may not be all dry in the weeks ahead. But they do say that some of those showers, when they fall, depending on whether it's this week, next week, or the week after, they could actually be solid water, as in hail or snow falling. I know this morning when I looked out, I see a few snowflakes around me. Now, it's a classical case of one swallow doesn't make a summer, and one snowflake doesn't make a snowfall. But nonetheless, it's interesting just to see them starting. But yeah. Monday, the rain on Monday there for the northwest. It's the only day that there is rain in the forecast for the northwest and also for the west. So there's obviously something coming in over the west and northwest on Monday. A little bit more rain on Tuesday and Wednesday in other areas, 3 to 6 mil. Now, 3 mil is not a lot of rain in numbers, but it's a lot of water if you're trying to get back out on ground. So it could actually disrupt what's going on. But it's probable that ground would stay frozen for the week ahead, but it might not be frozen as deep as we might like it if we're going to drive through wet patches.
Yeah, and you know you have it in management. Don't forget the antifreeze anyway, whatever you do.
Oh, yeah. And antifreeze, where it might be needed, not just where you know it's needed. If you're putting antifreeze in the sprayer, and we were with people on Tuesday, and some of them were going home to put the antifreeze back into the sprayer because they had the sprayer out. Mm-hmm. And if you put antifreeze in the sprayer, you know, make sure you circulate it into every single pipe and piece of equipment on the sprayer. Don't just run it out in the booms, but you should run it out in the booms as well when you've circulated it through everything else.
Yeah,
because you won't know it's done harm until the first day you take it out in the springtime, and that's going to be a pain in the ass.
Yeah, that's the day you don't want something bad to happen. Well, thanks a mil for that, Andy, and I think we'll draw the podcast to a close at that. So, thanks, Andy. Thanks to you, of course, our audience for listening. Thanks to Jerome and Claire back at base who do the editing, and you know, keep safe over the next week on the farm and keep the tillage flag flying.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.